Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I would love to tell you that the banking industry doesn't need any regulations. We can just trust them to operate responsibly on their own, but clearly that's not the case.
The bank failures were really idiosyncratic in nature. In terms of whether there's more coming, I think it's unlikely.
We think the capital gains decreases will help make it more affordable to be an investor in a business in Massachusetts.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business
with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortsleeve, and Kim Kerrigan
on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
All right, let's get started. Welcome to the 3 o'clock hour of Bloomberg Bay State Business. We're with you till 6 o'clock tonight. It's Wednesday, June the 7th. Joe Shortsleeve, Tom Maroney, Kim Kerrigan, and Master Janet Wu. Yeah, the gang's all here. And as you look out the window, we don't have as much smoke as they have in New York City, that's for sure. But I guess we've had some and a lot of news on this on that front. We're going to be talking about our smoky skies throughout the program. I guess they had a ground stop at LaGuardia Airport, but that was finally lifted. Anyway, as we come on the air, equity markets are mixed. The Dow's up 100 points or 0.3 of a percent. NASDAQ is off 135 points or 1.1%. In this hour, Janet Wu sits down with actor Mark Wahlberg. You know, it's an exclusive interview. He was in Boston visiting his pop-up clothing line known as Municipal. And I don't know about you, Tom and Kim, but, you know, when I look at, you know, some of the credits to him, I mean, The Perfect Storm, Planet of the Apes, The Italian Job, The Departed, I mean, those are among some of my favorite movies, so... I guess I'm a fan.
Popular guy there. All right, Joe. No,
well, I'm not done yet.
Oh,
Tom.
Please.
You know what I mean? Just no. Sit back.
Why don't you just
sit
keep
back.
On talking?
Yeah, sit back. Get yourself an umbrella drink.
I'll go get a drink.
It's going to be a while here.
Top
you
of the 4
talk.
O'clock hour, we have the CFO of the Boston Red Sox, Tim Zhu. He'll talk about the summer concert series at the Ball Yard, pickleball, and maybe a couple of questions about the team's status early in the season. And Kim Kerrigan, what's on your mind?
Well, it may be a little bit smoky out there, no. But that shouldn't keep anybody from heading over to Boston's City Hall Plaza today, oh, because today is when the big beer garden reopens there. It's again, I was telling you about it earlier this week. It's two city-based breweries, Distraction Brewery, which is from Roslindale, and Democracy Brewery from Downtown Crossing. They have beer. They have live music. They have all kinds of events. It's open from Wednesday through, I believe, Sunday. So it's closed on Mondays and Tuesdays for the rest of the summer.
Do they serve food at these beer gardens?
They do. There's all kinds of food booths. Oh, okay. And so I think it's a really kind of a fun.
Do they have brats?
I'll bet they do. Don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, I love brats, by the way. That's such a summer thing, right?
Brats. Might get a glimpse of the mayor going in and out of the city hall or something.
That's it, dancing her way in and out.
All right. So listen, as Joe just mentioned, Mark Wahlberg was in Boston recently. He visited a pop-up of his clothing brand. It's called Municipal, and you can see it online, of course. But it's in the Seaport. He gave Janet Wu an exclusive interview.
For me, Municipal is an aspirational brand. You know, the name comes from any basketball court, tennis court, public facility that people have started in. And then next thing you know, like Grant Williams here from the Boston Celtics, you could play in the NBA. So it doesn't matter where you start. Humble beginnings are actually, certainly in my mind, an advantage as opposed to a disadvantage. Because it does push you to work harder, but having less always drives you. You know, to accomplish more. So it's all about aspiration. It's all about trying to get somebody to be the best version of themselves.
Was there a moment that inspired you to start this?
Yes. I mean, look, I've always wanted to be in the apparel space. I've always wanted to build brands. I think, you know, I've had partnerships with Nike and various other brands out there. But I said, you know, if I want to do something, I got to kind of build my own. And so we looked for the right partner, and then we just decided the best way to accomplish what we wanted to was just to kind of start from scratch and build our own brand. So we found some people who were successful in the space working for various brands, and we kind of pulled them away and incentivized them to bet on themselves and have ownership, and that's kind of how we got here.
You seem to love business. You have the F45 workouts. You have the partnership on Wahlburgers. Tell me about this love of business, and what are you getting out of being an entrepreneur versus being an actor?
I was a serial entrepreneur since the very beginning, and also, I had to be, in order to be successful to the point that I am in film and television, I also had to have an entrepreneurial spirit. I needed to find material that I could produce. You know, I wasn't the first guy on anybody's list early on. You know, I was probably the last guy on anybody's list early on. So I had to kind of create my own path, find things. So that's how I got into producing. You know, looking for material, things I could develop and star in myself or just produce. And then started, you know, financing content and things of that nature. So I knew I always had to better myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ownership for me has always been the key. So, I mean, since I was a kid, shoveling snow, you know, selling newspapers, anything I could do, being the youngest of nine kids, if you wanted something, you know, unless it was going to be a hand-me-down from one of my siblings, and by that time it wasn't in good shape, you know, quite a lot of holes and a lot of distress. So if I wanted something, I had to go out there and work for it.
Dare I ask, do you like being in business as much as you like acting?
You know, it depends. I think, you know, while I'm making movies, have afforded me all these other opportunities, but it also takes me away from home, takes me away from my family, and I want to be able to be at home more, and I want to build the legacy that I can pass on to my kids. I spent lots of time acting. It's my first love and my passion, but, you know, I really love business, and I love the fact that if I want to go and make a movie, then I'm also in a position to go make a movie, finance it myself, and be in the driver's seat in every aspect.
Most stars who launch brands, they do it in a different way. They get star endorsements, they get stars to wear their brands, they do big splashy parties. We are standing in a 119 square foot shed in the Seaport. Why did you decide that you want to do things like this?
You know, we're building it one customer at a time. We know how to get in the weeds. We want to connect with people. A lot of people also, especially since the pandemic, use that as an excuse to keep people at arm's length. I'm trying to connect with people, and I'm trying to connect people in general. There's been such a divide lately, and I think, you know, to be able to communicate directly with customers, find out, you know, and I'll just also, you know, look, I'm a regular guy from a small neighborhood here. I was fortunate enough to be able to go and do some pretty extraordinary things, but I don't take any of that for granted. I keep working, and I know the only way to build a brand is to be involved and be engaged. People, especially consumers know the difference between somebody who's endorsing a product and somebody who actually owns and has built a product or a brand. There's a big, big difference.
So let's talk about the equity part of the brand that you mentioned. It's not just you. You have a bunch of partners. How is this working?
Oh, we don't have a bunch of partners. Really, I have three partners. We started out with three founders of the company. We were originally going to start out doing a joint venture. I had met with every brand out there, like I said, Nike, Puma, Adidas, Under Armour. I did shoes with the Jordan brand. And then I basically had met with Harry, who was working at Callaway on OGO. And he was like, you know, let's do a joint venture together. And then he was like, well, I've built a bunch of brands for this company. What if we wanted to kind of build our own brand? And I said, absolutely. I initially had somebody who was financing the company. And, you know, once COVID hit, they had to pull the plug on one of our five different ventures. And they decided it was municipal because it was in its earliest stage. So that's when things got real. And they had already left their jobs to start this new venture. And so everybody had to kind of really put their hand in their pockets and finance the business themselves. And Harry refinanced his house. And, you know, here we are now getting into the shoe business, and the company is growing at a pretty rapid rate. But again, we're all invested in a very real way. So,
do you also think that some companies, the big brands that you mentioned, the big companies you mentioned, are hesitant to, say, do these partnership with stars because they don't always go well, like what would happen with Kanye West, because it became too personal?
Well, Kanye's built a lot of amazing brands, and Kanye's a special talent. There's lots of other things that have gone into that. But I think when I think of a lot of celebrity brands that companies are hesitant to get involved, is that people have a tendency to just want to put their name on something and get a check. If it works, great, and if not, they're on to the next. I think they had a difference of opinion and conduct and personal beliefs and that sort of thing. But I think for the most part, we are kind of like the anti-celebrity brand in that we are involved in every aspect. We're not just putting our name on something. We're not just getting a check. We're building it. We own it. You know, it's very different from endorsing a product as opposed to owning something.
Describe for me, what is here? You know, what do you want it to represent? Who do you want to wear it? What do you want them to feel?
Well, I want them to feel like this is the greatest product they've ever put on. This is the gift for the everyman, like Lara Piana, Gift of Kings, Vicuña material is for somebody who can afford to buy a $7,000.
I hope this does not cost the same as a Cunha.
No, but a $9,000 sweater. And I bought a lot of different products to really kind of figure out, we want to offer something that is a huge value proposition to a customer. This is all aspirational. So when people work hard, they want to reward themselves with something nice. People don't mind spending a premium for a great product that is really quality. So, but this is all about the aspirational movement, inspiring everybody to just be the best versions of themselves, and no matter where they come from, what obstacles they may face, that there isn't anything they can't accomplish if they're willing to go and do the work.
It appears like streetwear. Is it high-end streetwear?
It's streetwear. It's athleisure. It's like if you took like a Lululemon and say like a Loro Piana and a Supreme and you jam them all together. This is like cool street. We're not afraid of color. You want to look good, feel good, super high quality, functional, but it also, you know, it's got to have that swagger.
You have your Boston roots. You now live elsewhere. But how does Boston influence this brand?
Listen, this is where it all started. You know, if I didn't grow up in the rough streets of Dorchester and figure out how to find my way, I wouldn't have been building this brand. Like I said, this is an aspirational brand for the everyman who is out to accomplish a lot more than people expected. Surpassing the expectations that they kind of probably are put on them every day.
You have all these businesses now, plus that movie career, which is still pretty active. Are we going to find more businesses, more startups, more business ventures from you?
We're kind of got our hands full. We're focusing on the things that we're already doing. If something kind of comes in and is a natural fit to what we're doing in this whole kind of entire ecosystem of wellness and, you know, experience, and if it fits and it's also another direct extension of who I am and what I do, then maybe, but we're not looking for anything else, that's for sure.
The Bio International Conference continuing today, the largest gathering of biopharma executives in the world. It's about 20,000, and it's back at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center for the first time since 2018. Bloomberg's Ann Mostu has been both moderating, and reporting there. Today, she listened to the head of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration give the keynote address. And she talked with executives from Verge Genomics, and she joins us right now in our Boston studio. Ann.
Yes, Joe, Tom, and Kim. Lots of interest in the opening keynote from FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf. He's a cardiologist appointed by President Biden. In a chat with conference organizer Bio International CEO Rachel King, Califf talked about attacks on the accelerated approval pathway.
My mom benefited from accelerated approval in a fairly famous case. She's passed away now, but she got 3 or 4 extra years and died in her 90s with her multiple myeloma, and it was a tremendous benefit. So I'm totally in favor of accelerated approval. When it's a serious life-threatening condition, there's no effective treatment.
Califf also spoke about court cases challenging the FDA's authority.
I can't say really much of anything about the particular case except that we're confident in the decisions that have been made. FDA's decision-making in this case made by experts with access to all the latest scientific data. This is something that's been ongoing for over 20 years, and the data really haven't changed. So we're confident in our decision-making. We're also very concerned about the impact of potential court decisions on what you describe, the fundamental basis by which the industry has a rational basis. Because most things fail. If you don't sort out the things that don't work, you could have an entire marketplace full of drugs where the risks outweigh the benefits. We think it's very important that that fundamental statutory basis for the existence of FDA continues to stay intact. And, you know, the implications of this go beyond your industry, obviously big implications for patients and many other parts of society.
There's been a lot of talk and frustration at this conference around the Federal Inflation Reduction Act passed last year to enact drug pricing controls on the medications that Medicare spends the most money on annually. Some say it's killing drug innovation and hampering development of new treatments. Califf addressed that, too.
I think the prices of drugs are too high in the U.S., and we have to come to grips with it. The impact on public health is substantial. Financial toxicity is something the cancer community has talked about a lot. That is, people who suffer health consequences because they don't take their drugs because they're trying to save money. But it's not even bread and butter heart failure, my specialty. We're seeing that a lot now. So we have to come up with a better system, and the IRA is an effort to do that. And I think maintaining patent protection is its work. When people criticize the FDA, one thing I love to say is, okay, name me a country that has a more rational system and any country that's better at innovating in medical products than the U.S. And people say, well, we can't really argue with that. So I think fundamentally the system has worked, but we've got to tweak it.
At every biopharma conference, there's at least one panel or speech about drug pricing and a lot of blame put on pharmacy benefit managers. Califf also commented on those and supply chain issues.
We have almost 300 impending drug shortages every year now. This goes back to 2011, since records have been kept. There's a team in CDER that scrambles around and tries to help the industry find its way. What's causing it is that we have now bifurcated fundamentally into two industries, the innovator industry, which is mostly represented here. In my opinion, the basis of your industry is you're given patent protection for a period of time that allows you to recoup the enormous cost of development because of most of what you do fails. But the generics industry is on a whole different basis. The industry is copying drugs that are already proven to work, and therefore the view has been the only basis of competition is price. And we've developed a system, very strangely in this country, where you have manufacturers who are now mostly not in the U.S. because they can't afford to be in business in the U.S. And you have a whole series of intermediaries, a little bit like the PBMs.
Yeah.
I know your favorite folks right now, but we have GPOs and distributors, and then you have the hospitals, pharmacies, and all that are buying. The signal from the hospitals and pharmacies is get us the lowest cost. These guys are getting better and better at getting the lower cost. The contracts allow them to drop a manufacturer immediately if they find a lower cost manufacturer, but not vice versa. So it's a one-sided contracting without a guarantee of income for a period of time. So most of the shortages now are caused by two things. One is companies just go out of business, can't make a profit. And the other is lack of investment in quality. So then an FDA inspection occurs, there's a quality problem, and then to fix it, it costs capital and no one's going to invest in a money-losing business. So with many people, when I talk about prices too low, people say that can't be because we all know prices are too high. But they're talking about two very different industries. My personal view is there's enough money in the system in generics, but the margins are going to the wrong people, and we're just going to have to invest more and have a system where quality is recognized.
Again, that's FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf. I also spoke with a company that's really putting the new tech in biotech. Verge Genomics is a private company already in the clinic using artificial intelligence for drug discovery. They're headquartered in San Francisco, but have several employees in Boston. Jane Rhodes is a Biogen veteran and chief business officer.
We are a company that uses human data to drive drug discovery using artificial intelligence and machine learning, which are in and of themselves applications that can help us understand really complex data and complex biology and allow us to provide new insights into how pathways impact disease.
And you're focusing on neurological diseases, diseases of the central nervous system, is that correct?
We are. That's where we started as a company. Our focus has been on diseases like ALS, motor neuron disease, frontotemporal dementia, Parkinson's disease. And that's because they're very complex diseases. They have a high unmet need. Our lead program is in ALS, and there's a very flexible regulatory pathway towards approval with ALS today because of the tremendous high unmet need. So they were all strategic decisions as to why we started with the brain. But it's the platform itself is completely disease agnostic. We can apply it to any type of disease.
So how are you approaching these differently than any other drug company?
Our thesis is that to improve the probability of technical success of finding a drug and getting it to market, that you need to start with high quality information that is drawn from the patient, so directly from human tissue. So we go to great pains to identify and acquire tissue from patients who are suffering from the disease that we're interested in exploring, and then we develop and create multi-omic data layers from that tissue to really paint a picture of the complex biology that's underpinning the disease.
And you're using human tissue rather than the tissue from mice, for example, or any other animals?
Yes, exactly. So many traditional approaches to discovering novel targets for new drugs comes from cell-based screens or animal models or even, you know, basic organisms and basic exploratory biology. Our approach is exclusively to use human tissue because we believe that's where you can unlock the real biology that's driving disease.
And are you using tissue samples?
Our discovery efforts are drawn from samples taken from patients who have died from the disease that we're studying, so post-mortem tissue samples in the case of the brain. In some diseases, it's possible to acquire tissues from patients who are living with the disease, for example, atopic dermatitis is a good example where skin biopsies are relatively easy to find. But we use post-mortem tissues from patients who've died from the disease.
Again, that's Jane Rhodes, Chief Business Officer at Verge Genomics. They've raised $134 million in equity financing across two rounds with investment from companies including Eli Lilly and Merck's Global Health Innovation Fund. Definitely a company to watch. Bio continues tomorrow, but it's a smaller program. It'll wrap up around lunchtime. And the big keynote speakers, obviously today the FDA commissioner, and yesterday was Katie Couric on patient advocacy.
Yeah, I heard her.
Those are all done. So today is really a big networking, big cocktail parties and dinner parties tonight. And then things wrap up. People fly out tonight and tomorrow.
Well, we'll talk about one of our favorite subjects now, the old ball yard, Fenway Park, and the Boston Red Sox. And let's bring in Tim Zhu. He's Chief Financial Officer and Executive Vice President, I believe, as well. We first met Tim at a remote broadcast right there in Fenway and had a wonderful conversation with this guy. Tim, welcome back. I know you're a Winchester guy, went to MIT. Now you're here with the Red Sox. We want to talk about a lot of the different things that Park does, but I want to start with this because it got me thinking before this conversation. Let's talk about pickleball, for instance, middle of July. Are you a pickleball fan, by the way?
I am now. I haven't played pickleball myself, but I've been following the craze. It's one of the fastest growing sports, and it seems like cities are putting up courts all over the place, and so I have paid more attention over the last few months, for sure.
As we have, too. So as I understand it, in the middle of July, you're going to be able to pay a fee, go in and play pickleball, and these pickleball courts will be around the outfield, or around the, let's say, the outfield. Here's what I'm getting at. If you want to go do something at Fenway, and pickleball is the example I'm using, you can hope to play pickleball in the same turf that Yaz wandered and that Fred Lynn roamed and that Jim Rice roamed. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at, do you guys ever sit down and say, if you know, the decision not to tear down Fenway, call it the X factor, has to be worth so much more. People want to go do these things partly because it's old Fenway Park.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that decision that Larry Lucchino and John Henry and Tom Werner and the ownership group made, you know, their pledge, they were the only group when they were doing the bidding process that said they wanted to save Fenway, rebuild Fenway, everybody else wanted to move it, was one of the best decisions we've ever made. I mean, I think there is no limit to the appetite for people to come to Fenway Park and see and do unique and different things. And pickleball is just one example.
Tim Zhu's our guest, Chief Financial Officer. Let's drill a little deeper on that. You know, because you look at a season of 162 games, right, and 81 games there on the road. And I'm wondering, Tim, over the years, 81 days means they were on the road. So 81 days, Fenway Park could have been pretty much empty or not used. And I'm wondering, how many of those 81 days now are you starting to fill up with different business opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, we probably have, if you count, you know, somebody renting a suite with 25 people and having a business meeting or maybe having a wedding, I mean, you know, we have maybe upwards of 1,000 of those, you know, events. So you know, Fenway, we think of it as a 365-day venue. I mean, we have something going on pretty much every day with maybe the exception of Christmas Day or, you know, Thanksgiving when we give our staff the days off. But, you know, the larger events, you know, the ones that sort of are, you know, like this pickleball event, we probably have maybe 100. You know, we have the 81 baseball games. We hope we have upwards of 11 or 12 October baseball games, you know, every year. And then we'll have, you know, concerts. We've got 12 concerts already booked for the year. We had this offseason, we obviously had the Winter Classic and other college hockey and bowl games. So, you know, probably close to 100 of the bigger ones. You know, Northeastern had their graduation most recently. It was a full ballpark-wide event. We're just constantly wanting to bring people to Fenway, and like I said, the demand and appetite doesn't wane.
Are you booked? Are you booked through the end? Are you booked through when?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say we're ever booked because one of the things about Fenway is there's so many unique spaces, right? So if you have a group and you want to come in, you can come in into the Dell Technologies Club. You can come into the new 521 Perch in the outfield. You can do an event if it's smaller in the Ford Clubhouse. You can do it in one of our suites if it's even smaller. You know, so we have, you know, our events team has probably 15 or 20 different spaces to sell. And on some ballpark, on some days, there's you know, six or seven different events going on in those different spaces. Now, these larger ones, those are harder to come by because, you know, you have to plan them on a road trip. There's setup required. You know, so we don't have a lot of windows, road trip windows, to do these larger ones anymore. They're filled up with concert stages and pickleball courts.
Tim Zhu is with us, the Boston Red Sox CFO. Tim, I would love to get a hold of a list of those ideas that were brought up but didn't make it. In other words, when you brainstorm and you come up with pickleball, you come up with concerts, and we can go on and on. What are the ideas that you looked at each other around that table and said, nah, no, no?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not so much that it ended up being no. It just ended up that maybe we couldn't make the economics work. You know, we looked at an exhibition tennis match. We looked at trying to get a Serena Williams or a Roger Federer, you know, to come play and what it would cost to sort of put that on from court setup.
Why wouldn't that work?
Well, I think, you know, the sort of cost to attract those athletes, you know, they command such a premium in terms of the cost that you have to start doing the math to say, well, what would I have to charge for tickets? Do we think we're going to be able to do that? You know, so you know, we've looked at things like that. We've looked at lacrosse. We've looked at, you know, there's pretty much no sport that we've tried to convince the Patriots to come play a game here. And they have 70,000 seats over at their place, so the economics don't really work on that either. Mm. You know, just to come over here and have 5,000 seats instead of 70,000.
I saw a Patriots game at Fenway Park as a boy.
Yeah, they used to be their home ballpark. That's what we tried to pitch them on the – it was a very constructive conversation. It's just, again, the math doesn't really work, you know.
Well, you have a whole list of concerts coming up. I mean, and we have them here in front of us basically going on June 25th, June 23rd, August, you know, August 1st, July 31st, August. How do those numbers work? How do the financials work? How do the Red Sox, you know, make a cut a deal with a concert?
Yeah, you know, it's actually pretty simple in the sense that live. So most of these acts, and you've got Dead and Company, Pink, Morgan Wallen, Zac Brown, Guns N' Roses, they have a promoter in the sense that it's usually either Live Nation or AEG. We have almost exclusively worked with Live Nation. It has nothing against AEG. It's just how it's worked out. So Live Nation will sort of represent the band. They'll come in, and essentially they'll rent Fenway Park, and they'll pay a rental fee. And, you know, we get to keep concessions and things like that. We pay our own expenses. The musician keeps really the lion's share of the economics.
What's the fee to rent Fenway Park?
Well, I don't want to go into details, but
Tim, we won't tell anyone.
It's not really a detail. It's just one number.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. You know, it depends. But I will say, you know, it's usually for something like that, what we call a ballpark-wide buyout. It can be in the mid to upper six figures, you know, something like
mid
that.
Mid to upper six.
But you know, it's not millions of dollars, but it's, you know. So the way the concerts work is just at a high level. The Live Nation comes in, they do the stage setup, they, you know, handle the act, get in on and selling the tickets. And we're not even really selling the tickets, we're just sort of the rental, we're just the venue. Yeah. So they pay us, you know, a rental, and then there's some upside related to, you know, hot dogs and beers.
Tim, when you do your budgeting and when you talk about, you know, what your goals and so forth financially, obviously the team, the Sox, are bringing in the revenue, they're filling that stadium. In these other events, you probably have a smaller audience and so forth. I mean, but tell us about your goals here. I mean, if the team is still the revenue source, I mean, how close is everything else as an aggregate? Is it 60-40, 70-30?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we actually had this conversation on opening day, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it was at the FBI event. But, you know, this other stuff is still small, you know, it's still 5% of revenue.
Well,
you know,
I thought something it'd be more.
But I think the more important thing, when we think of an event like pickleball, we think of two things. Number one, we might make a few bucks. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to pay Rafael Devers his contract by any means. But more importantly, you're attracting a new, different demographic to Fenway. You're getting, anytime someone sets foot in Fenway Park and has a good experience, whether we make a money or not, that's a good thing. You know, so we're trying to create these experiences that attract different, unique demographics to Fenway, to hope that they experience Fenway, they tell their friends they had a great time at Fenway, and then, you know, that's like free marketing.
We're going to get into this. A LIV Golf merger with the PGA now. Jesse Menachem is the executive director and CEO of Mass Golf. He's been with us before, and he's back again. And, Jesse, thanks for being with us. I suppose it's not a good day for golf if we have smoke out there. Do you have any reports of the the golf course is being shut down because of this?
Well, thank you for having me. Fortunately, we've been in an okay place there for the last couple of days, but it's definitely something to keep a close eye and watch on. Okay. We've got several events going on statewide, so definitely want to be cautious.
So, listen, my friend Joe Shortsley believes this golf is now going to turn into an all-night free-for-all. No, I'm exaggerating. But the fact that LIV, with all its shenanigans and watering holes and everything else, is going to invade the staid and studious game of golf as we know it and change things. What do you say?
Well, it's certainly been an eventful 24, 36 hours here in our industry. There's a lot of questions and a lot of unknowns. I mean, obviously a monumental day in many respects with the announcement of the PGA Tour and those involved with LIV. So a lot to be really worked out and figured out. You know, we understand that there's this notion of partnership at the national and even international level. For us locally in Massachusetts, time will tell, right? We'll have to see what comes of this and how it potentially will impact the game and the industry.
Well, let's talk about that. How do you see this impacting the game and the industry? I mean, what does this merger do to the game of golf itself? And you could talk about it on a national level if you'd like.
Well, for us, I mean, we locally here, we've seen some incredible trends and momentum in these last couple of years post-pandemic. We've seen record highs with membership, with participation, you name it. So that being said, now we've got this partnership, this potential shift at the national, international level. Perhaps this does help the game globally. And it's always, you know, we're bullish about that. And, you know,
why do you say that? Why will this help the game?
Well, it's hard for me to really say whether or not it's going to help the game long term. We don't know what the objectives are of the new entity, of the new partnership. We know the PGA Tour is going to run their events from what it sounds like. There are going to be LIV events and other events and such. So there's so much to be worked out. It really just sounds like they've got a shell of an agreement in place. But nonetheless, you know, there's going to be resources and representatives who want to see the game grow, and that's not just here in the States. That will be global.
Jesse Menachem is with us. He's executive director and CEO of Mass Golf. We're talking about this merger, LIV and PGA. So, Jesse, I'm wondering, you know, I like my golf stayed quiet. I like the people to whisper what's happening. That's why I sit down to the Masters every year, because I don't necessarily golf a lot, but that's what I like. What I'm wondering is whether or not this is generational. And you have a unique vantage point. You see people of all ages out there on our golf courses in the Commonwealth. Do the young people play a different game, and are they more drawn, for instance, to, well, there was a LIV event out in Bolton last year, I believe. I'm not sure if you attended, but I know that it drew people. Is there a younger audience there willing and ready to accept this LIV form of golf?
Well, again, we don't know the future of LIV, so time will tell on that. But to your point, we have seen some changes in the game. You know, we've got some new generations involved, and even in the world we live in, right, everything's a little more casual. And I think we are seeing some ramifications of that. We've got a lot of new golfers that entered the game post-pandemic, so there's a lot to be learned and educated on. But at the same time, I think we want to be flexible and nimble to these new golfers and the next generation, because we want them to enjoy the game. And how does the game fit into their lifestyle? Tradition is important, as we know, and I respect where you're coming from. I kind of fall into that category. Yeah. But as a younger person as well, I can see where things are trending, and we know how experiential, you know, some of these demographics are in this day and age. You know, they really want to get a lot out of what they're experiencing in a 2-3-4 hour outing.
Talking with Jesse Menachem, he's the executive director of the Massachusetts Golf Association. You know, not that you can compare it to the pitch clock in baseball, but that did change. That is in the process of changing the game. But I'm wondering, was the PGA ripe for this? And I don't mean necessarily because of LIV, but was the PGA just sort of too stodgy, too slow, too quiet?
That's a good question. I don't think it would totally fit that definition. I think they've wanted and needed to evolve a bit, and perhaps the scenario over the last 12 or 18 months has expedited that or accelerated that. But I think they're wanting to make sure the PGA Tour product is for all ages, all genders, and to be as inclusive as possible and diverse as possible. So again, it's one of these things. We don't know what's going to come of it. We don't know what the goals and objectives of this new entity will be.
So, Jesse, let's take a quick check of the pulse, if you will, of golf in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I mean, you represent a lot of these golf courses. How many members do you have?
We have 340 member clubs statewide, mm-hmm. and we have 113,000 individual golfers that we service.
So when you have golf courses that aren't members. I'm sure it's a minority, right?
It is. There are a handful, but majority speaking, yes, we do have most of the state covered.
So is that number, it's 340 you just said, is that going up? Is that going down? Is it staying the same? Are we seeing an expansion of the game here?
Well, as far as facilities go, we're a little bit land-strapped and locked, as we all know. So
right.
We don't expect new facilities to be built by the dozens anytime soon, but we're seeing public facilities filled up with tee times. We're seeing wait lists at private facilities that, you know, at certain facilities did not have that experience 5, 10, 15 years ago. So these clubs are seeing some significant activity, some significant interest, and I think they're doing a great job of catering to golfers, their lifestyles, their schedules. You know, it's not that 18-hole traditional round anymore. It might be an hour and a half before work or after work that they can squeeze in an experience with themselves, with friends, with family, what have you.
Jesse, what has the past 24 hours been like for you, a profession in this field? First of all, I guess, when you first heard the news, what was your reaction? And since then, what have the professionals been saying to you?
You know, the first blip or alert I saw, it was I couldn't really believe it. I had to dig in a little bit further, read it the second or third time, and then from there, you know, it became calls, texts, emails, and, you know, I've been using the word chaos. I don't like to use it, but it feels that way. You know, there's a lot of unknown uncertainty, and as we're hearing and learning, a lot of people were in the dark on this, right? It was a small group effort that was able to come to a deal here, and from there, word started to get out, you know, communication to national, international governing bodies, the players of the PGA Tour, and just starting to piece together, you know, really the sequence of events and what this is all about.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're watching some of the big names, like Rory McIlroy, for instance, number three in the world right now. He had a lot of things to say in a critical way about this Live Golf League. Today, say, well, you know, down the road, 10 years from now, this is going to be good for the game. I still don't like Live, but good for the game. Now, Rory is splitting hairs, as we say. I mean, what was the initial reaction? Were you, oh, my goodness, this is not good? What was your gut first reaction to this? I mean, you couldn't believe it, but was it a good I can't believe it or bad?
A little bit of both, you know, at different hours of the day. And as I uncovered certain, you know, nuggets here and, you know, perhaps, yes, 5, 10 years down the road, this could be extremely beneficial. You know, we're seeing other industries and other sports arenas have, you know, really tremendous growth and success. But it's really about what are those tangible goals and how are we going to mobilize from a national or international standpoint. I'm curious. I think that's how I'd really sum this up. I'm curious what this really could call for. We're in a groove right now in the industry of momentum, of awareness and engagement. So let's not spoil that. You know, let's make sure we're sustaining it in the right way.
Mm. Jesse Menachem, you got 30 seconds. Tell us about the tournaments you got going on in the state right now.
Thank you. Yeah, we are knee-deep right now. Today we've got a handful of events, one being a U.S. Women's Open qualifier to get into the national championship. We're on the doorstep of the Mass Open Championship, and we're qualifying for several other state championships, so the Mass Amateur, soon to be the Amateur Public Links, the Women's Amateur,
So we are ready for a full season. We've got incredible demand, wait list for just about every event. So we're excited, and hopefully we can see some turn in the weather.
Wait a second. We have breaking news.
We are number one.
We're number one. We're number one.
The big dog. Roof, roof.
Big dog. Roof, roof.
I'm Joey Tribbiani, and here are today's top stories.
All right, Joey, thank you. Thank you very much. The headline on the number one story on the Bloomberg Terminal, Wall Street's once hot trades of 2023 unraveling in markets. All right. Call this the latest setback for conventional wisdom, because nearly halfway into 2023, these consensus bets that everyone has been talking about, they are losing in a big way. What are we talking about? All right, here are a couple examples of the strategies that have misfired. Number one, selling big tech stocks. No. Snubbing the dollar. No. And finally, buying into the promise of emerging market equities as China emerged from COVID. Instead, well, U.S. growth shares are up on the cusp of full-blown melt-up, and Chinese stocks are sinking into a bear market. So, again, a setback for conventional wisdom, the number one story on the Bloomberg Terminal. Joe.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Taking a look at the headlines as they relate to the proposed merger of the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Well, yesterday's headline was PGA Tour bows to Saudi rival in shock deal with LIV Golf. Today, another headline, surprise golf marriage of PGA and LIV risk antitrust scrutiny. Secondary headline, rival golf tours say the tie-up doesn't need merger review. Others say the partnership raises serious antitrust concerns in the U.S. and the U.K. Let's bring in Bloomberg reporter Leah Nyland. She covers antitrust issues for us, and we welcome her to the program. Leah, tell us what you found.
Yeah, so LIV and PGA have been very clear that this is not a merger. If it were a merger, they would be required to file for antitrust approval in multiple places. Instead, they're talking about it as a partnership. But just because you call something a partnership and not a merger doesn't mean that the antitrust officials are not going to be interested. There was a pretty big case that Boston folks might be familiar with earlier this year involving American and JetBlue, who had partnered in the Northeast. And they said it wasn't a merger. The Justice Department said, well, it's a de facto merger. And a judge in Boston was actually found for the Justice Department there.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of situations in which the Justice Department might not necessarily agree with the companies about what is a merger and what is not.
Well, I mean, is there a way to say simply what the difference is between a merger and a partnership? I mean, is there a way to do this where they could escape this scrutiny? I mean, the airline case you mentioned went to court.
Yeah. I mean, the Justice Department would probably have to sue and bring this to court if they want to block it. What their concerns are is, you know, LIV has brought a lot of new energy and innovation into the golf industry. They have been offering pretty big payouts to a lot of golfers to join their tour. And obviously, if they combine now into one, that's no longer going to be on offer. You know, there were a lot of golfers who were pretty upset about this announcement yesterday because maybe they had turned down the money from LIV, and now here they're going to end up being bought by the Saudi Arabian, you know, fund anyway. So the Justice Department is obviously pretty concerned about that. Also how, you know, them combining may impact things like sponsorship or broadcast TV rights. The other sort of wrinkle in there is the third tour that said that they were going to join this partnership is based in London, and the UK's Competition and Markets Authority has been one of the most aggressive antitrust regulators this year.
Uh-huh. Well, the Department of Justice in this country has already opened this up. I mean, they were already looking at it prior to this announcement. So when do they show their hand about what they're up to next?
That's the interesting question. So, yeah, they had already been looking at this relationship with PGA and LIV since PGA had essentially blacklisted a couple of the golfers who had moved over to the other tour. So everyone thinks that they're pretty much going to now turn their attention to this proposed partnership. They'll probably send out, you know, subpoenas to get information on the agreement itself. Now the tours say that the agreement, you know, they have a written agreement, but not all the details are finalized. So, you know, they still could try and go in and maybe negotiate some aspects with the Justice Department. but probably also a lot of the golfers, particularly the ones who had had problems with PGA when they switched to LIV, are also going to be called in by the Justice Department to give some indication of what's happening under the new partnership.
Leah Nyland with us on these antitrust measures or issues surrounding the LIV Golf and PGA merger. Leah, this isn't exactly legal, but I was hoping it might shed some light on the big question for me is why did the PGA go ahead and do this? I mean, was there any sort of info that came across your desk or in your reporting that said they were either running out of money or they or these legal issues that LIV was raising were tough and that they were bound to lose?
I don't know necessarily know that it was early or late enough in the case to say that they were bound to lose. But the one thing that is interesting about antitrust cases is if you do lose, you are liable for treble damages. So it's not just whatever the people ask that gets tripled. So some of the damage claims in antitrust can be really, really high. So it's possible they thought, you know, if we sort of head this off now, reach an agreement, it might be better. You know, some of my colleagues had done sort of a deep dive into how this came about. You know, it was, you know, some of the top folks at PGA having personal conversations with the people at LIV and about, you know, sort of how they could innovate in the sport and what's best for golf overall. You know, the Justice Department doesn't necessarily care what's best for golf overall. They care about competition. So.
Right. Talking with Leah Nyland, Bloomberg reporter. She covers antitrust issues for us here. Well, you write in your story that basically this is the creation of a giant monopoly, right? I mean, isn't this a creation of a giant monopoly? Could they possibly argue it another way?
I mean, they could try. It is the creation of a giant monopoly, and you know we have them essentially in some other sports. But like you know, there is MLB, there is the NFL, but that's a little bit of a different animal. You know, MLB actually does have an explicit antitrust exemption, and some of the other groups have sort of argued that they're really just joint ventures among teams. And, you know, they have some sort of protections from antitrust law because of that. But this, you know, it's a single-player sport. It's not a team sport. So it's not like you have franchises like you do in some of these other sports. So it's a little more complicated. And antitrust authorities have been really nervous about situations, particularly when you have a dominant player who's been blacklisting athletes who are trying to join sort of like new upstart ones. That's come up in a bunch of other cases, you know, involving like soccer, also in the EU involving like speed skating. There was a big case about that a couple years ago.
There was a speed skating monopoly?
There was a speed skating monopoly.
That's why I come to work.
How did that escape us here at Bloomberg?
So tell us, you in your reporting on the same lines, you talk about this Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Yeah,
owner.
That was the most interesting.
Go ahead, talk about that one.
Yeah, so the owner of Ultimate Fighting Championship is a company called Zuffa. It's now owned by Endeavor. But it, back in the day, back in about 2011, bought its biggest competitor, which was another mixed martial art league called Strikeforce. Now, the antitrust division didn't look at that one. It was the Federal Trade Commission. And because mixed martial arts is sort of a not as well-known sport, they ended up saying that it was okay and that merger closed. But a bunch of the fighters actually have filed a lawsuit challenging that merger. They've argued that the fact that that merger closed meant that they no longer had competition for their skills and that they now earn a lot lower wages. And they have offered some pretty convincing evidence, at least to the judge in that lawsuit. It's a federal lawsuit out in Las Vegas. He's actually certified it as a class action on behalf of 1,200 fighters who have fought for UFC over the past decade, and it could end up being, you know, quite a lot of money that UFC has to pay out to those fighters if it is found liable.
You know, you mentioned that the UK legal authorities looking at this as well, and we got the DOJ here in this country. What if they came up with competing decisions?
Yeah, that has been another problem in antitrust of late. You may, if you pay attention to antitrust news, you may have heard about the Microsoft Activision case, in which the U.S. and the U.K. have vetoed it, but the European Commission said, actually, we think it might be all right. So generally, it's really hard if you are a global company or trying to do a global thing like PGA and LIV, you need approval from everybody, or you sort of would have to, like, carve out that one country. So, I mean, Microsoft there were reports that Microsoft was looking at whether it could stop doing business in the UK, and really that's pretty difficult to do.
Yeah.
So oftentimes when there's a global deal or a global partnership like this, unless you get everybody on board, you can't really go through with it.
All right. She's Leah Nyland. She covers antitrust for us here at Bloomberg. Very interesting. Very interesting. And Tom, you want to talk about tomorrow?
I do. So we have a couple things going on. We've been talking about this throughout the program. What are those fires in Canada? I don't have a good picture. We're going to talk to a reporter up there at the Toronto Star who's been covering all this. We're also going to talk about the Charlestown Marina, named the large marina of the year, and the economic impact these facilities have on our coastline. That's all coming up tomorrow. Bloomberg Daybreak Asia starts right now.